What did they do to her? Why doesn't she know me?
Do?
Moore shook his head, managed a half smile under listless eyes.
They didn't do anything, son. Nobody does anything. We're done, too.
The lights were always low in the attic, the better for Moore to see the visions in his head. He was a half-seen, half-human shape in the semi-darkness, one arm tracing languid circles in the air, all other limbs entwined among the rafters, as though the crown was incorporating him into her very bones, as though he were some degenerate, parasitic anglerfish in conjugal fusion with a monstrous mate. The smell of old sweat and pheromones hung around him like a shroud.
She found out about Bridgeport, Brooks hissed. She found out about me. She had all my stats right up there on the screen, and she didn't recognize me.
Oh, that,
Moore said, and nothing else.
This goes way beyond some tweak to protect state secrets. What did they do? What did you do?
Moore frowned, an old man losing track of seconds barely passed.
I didn't do anything. This is the first I've heard of it. She must have a filter.
A filter.
Cognitive filter.
The colonel nodded, intact procedural memories booting up over corrupt episodic ones.
Selectively interferes with the face recognition wetware in the fusiform gyrus. She sees you well enough in the flesh. She just can't recognize you in certain contexts. Triggers an agnosia. Probably even mangles the sound of your name.
I know what a cognitive filter is. What I want to know is why someone took explicit measures to keep Rakshi from recognizing me when nobody knew I was going to be on this goddamn ship. Because I just happened to go on sabbatical just before a bunch of postals decided to duke it out in the desert, right? Because I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I was wondering when you were going to figure that out, Moore said absently. I thought maybe someone had spiked your cognitol.
Brooks hit him in the face. At least he tried to. Somehow, the blow went wide. Somehow, Moore was just a little left of where he'd been an instant before, and his fist was ramming like a piston into Brooks's diaphragm. Brooks sailed backward. Something with too many angles and not enough padding cracked the back of his skull. He doubled over, breathless, floaters swarming in his head.
Unarmed biologist with no combat experience attacking a career soldier with 30 years in the field and twice your mitochondrial count, Moore remarked as Brooks struggled to breathe. Not generally a good idea.
Brooks looked across the compartment, holding his stomach. Moore looked back through eyes that seemed a bit more focused in the wake of his outburst.
How far back, Jim? Did they drop some subliminal cue into my inbox to make me choose Prineville? Did they make me fuck up the Sims and kill all those people just so I'd feel the urge to get lost for a while? Why did they want me along for the ride anyway? What possible reason could a bunch of super-intelligent cancers have for taking a cockroach on their secret mission?
You're alive, Moore said. They're not.
Not good enough.
We're alive, then. The closer you are to baseline, the better your odds of surviving the mission.
Tell that to Liana.
I wouldn't have to. I've told you before, Daniel, Roach isn't an insult. We're the ones still standing after the mammals build their nukes. We're the ones with the stripped-down OSs so damned simple they work under almost any circumstances. We're the goddamned Kalashnikovs of thinking meat.
Maybe it wasn't the bicams at all, Brooks said. Maybe I'm Sengupta's paycheck. That's how you operate, isn't it? You trade in ideology. You exploit passion. Sengupta does her job, and you remove the blinders and let her loose to take her revenge?
That's not it, Moore told him softly.
How do you know? Maybe you're just out of the loop. Maybe those orthogonal stealth nets are running you the way you think you're running Rakshi. You think everyone on the planet's a puppet except for Colonel Jim Moore?
Do you really think that's a likely scenario?
Scenario? I don't even know what the goddamned goal is. No matter who's pulling the strings, what have we accomplished other than nearly getting killed 150 million clicks from home?
Moore shrugged.
God knows.
Oh, very clever.
What do you want from me, Daniel? I'm not much more clued in than you are. No matter what Machiavellian motives you want to lay at my feet, the bicamerals see God in everything from the Virgo supercluster to a flushing toilet. Who knows why they might want us on board? And as for Rakshi's filter, how do you know your own people didn't do it?
My own people?
Public relations, faculty affairs, whatever your academic institutions use to keep their dirty laundry out of the public eye. They did a lot of mopping up after Bridgeport. How do you know Rakshi's tweak wasn't just another bit of insurance? Preemptive damage control, as it were.
He didn't, actually. The thought hadn't even occurred to him. Still doesn't explain why we both ended up on the same mission, he said at last.
Why?
The colonel snorted softly.
We're lucky if we even know what we've done. Any why simple enough for either of us to consciously understand would certainly be wrong.
Just not enough room in the cache, Brooks said bitterly. Moore inclined his head. So it's just God's will. All these augments, and all this technology, and 400 years of so-called enlightenment, and you still just come around to God's will.
For all we know, Moore said, your presence on the mission is the last thing God wants. Maybe that's the whole point.
Sengupta's voice in his head. Maybe worship, maybe disinfect. Lazily, almost indifferently, Jim Moore disentangled himself from the rafters and moved, spider-like, around the attic. Even in this artificial twilight, Brooks could see the slow change in his eyes, the focus deepening in stages, into Brooks's eyes, then past them, through the bulkhead, through the hull, past planets and elliptics, past dwarfs and comets and trans-Neptunians, all the way out to some invisible dark giant lurking between the stars. He's gone again, he thought, but not entirely. Moore dropped that distant gaze from Brooks's face, took his hand, pointed to a freckle there that Brooks hadn't noticed before. Another tumor, Brooks said, and Moore nodded distantly.
The wrong kind.
The sun diminished behind them. They jettisoned the parasol. Ahead, just a few degrees starboard, the Earth grew from dimensionless point to gray dot, edging infinitesimally closer to 12 o'clock with each arbitrary shipboard day. The solar wind no longer roared across every frequency. It spat and hissed and gave way to other voices, infinitely weaker, but so much closer to the ear. Jim Moore continued to feed on the archives that carried his son. Sengupta squeezed signal from noise and insisted that other patterns lay embedded there, if she could only decipher them. But the ghost that called itself Siri Keaton was only one voice on the ether. There were others, far too many for Brooks's liking. The world they'd left behind had been almost voiceless, scared into silence by the memory of regimented apparitions burning in the sky. But the voices were coming back now. The rapid-fire click trains of encrypted data, grainy approximations of faces and landscapes flickering along the 600 megahertz band, the hiss of carrier waves on reawakened frequencies, nominally active, but holding their tongues as if waiting for the firing of some starting pistol, a myriad languages, a myriad messages, weather reports, news feeds rotten with static, personal calls connecting families scattered across continents. The content of the signals wasn't nearly so troubling as their very existence out here in the unshielded wastes. They should have been trapped in lasers and fiber op, should have been winking confidentially between lines of sight. These broadcasts were relics of another age. The airtight machinery of 21st century telecommunications had begun leaking at the seams. People were falling back into more patchwork technologies. It was what a brain might do, stunted for want of nutrients and oxygen. It was the predictable decoherence of any complex system starved of energy. But it was home, and they were almost there. There was groundwork to be laid. Moore and Sengupta attended to the details, each returning from whatever far-off places they ventured when not guiding the Crown into port. The warrior divided the rest of his time between his tent and the attic. The widow continued to sleep obliviously with the enemy. The vampire lay like a fossil on the hull, undisturbed by whatever alarms or tripwires she might have put in place. Brooks measured the time to Worth by the size of its disc and the incremental unclenching of his own gut. He thought about getting back into gaming, briefly. He slept and dreamt his lucid dreams, but Rona would not come to him, and he no longer had the heart to seek her out. The guts of the crown continued to not grow tentacles. He finished the last of the Glenmorangie by himself, toasting his lab bench while they crossed lunar orbit. If anyone even noticed their return, they were too busy to send a welcoming committee. To travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive. Robert Louis Stevenson. Low fast orbit over a world in flames. 1,000 cool political conflicts had turned hot while they'd been away. Twice as many epidemiological and environmental ones. A myriad voices cried out on long-forgotten radio bands from kilohertz to giga. Tight beams swamped. Planetary gag orders rescinded or forgotten. The O'Neills were under quarantine. The space elevator had collapsed. Burning wreckage still fell from orbit, wrought untold havoc along a splatter cone wrapped around a third of the equator. Jetstream geoengineering had finally buckled beneath the weight of an insatiable atmosphere. Atlas had lost the strength to hold the heavens from the Earth. Atmospheric sulfates were plummeting, and firestorms sparkled endlessly across 6 continents. Pretoria, Bruges, 100 other cities had been overrun by zombies, millions reduced to fight, flight, fuck, and the authorities weren't even trying to control anything inside the hot zones. There was no end to the claims or the confusion. Icarus had fallen. The Fireflies had returned. The invasion had begun. The realists had struck. The bicamerals had destroyed the world. Moore listened to the tsunami along with Brooks and Sengupta, all 3 of them strapped into the mirror ball on approach, and his face was impassive as a corpse's. "This is your doing," Brooks did not say. "This was a world just making ends meet until you snatched away its biggest asset. All those millions kept barely watered by power-hungry desalinators. All those uprisings kept barely in check by the threat of institutional force. All those environmental catastrophes kept barely at bay by the sheer overwhelming application of brute force technologies. Icarus carried a solid 1/5 of our civilization on its back. What did you think would happen when you threw it into the sun?" Even Sengupta said nothing. There would have been no point. Enemy territory. Couldn't be helped. Maybe Moore was even right. The world had been simmering for over a century. It had always only been a matter of time before it boiled over. Maybe he hadn't done anything but advance the schedule by a few months.
"Got it," Sengupta said. "Just came line of sight over the Aleutians. Whole lot of junk between there and here."
A tactical profile flashed up on the horizon. A cylinder 10 meters across and maybe 30 long. A great broad corona of solar panels deployed from the star side end, and a cluster of mouthparts. Microwave emitters from the look of them, jutting down from the other. It looked like an old-style power sat, albeit in a very strange orbit. Which was, of course, the whole idea.
"Be tricky docking with that thing."
Off to one side, a simulacrum of the crown lazily lowered its remaining arms, spread-eagled, but already spun down, into lockdown position.
"We don't dock," Moore reminded her.
"How long?" Brooks asked.
30 minutes, give or take. We should bottle up."
The attic was not designed to be a working environment during maneuvers, but they'd made do. One survivor strapped into each of 3 suit alcoves directly across from the docking hatch. Brooks and Moore had welded it shut somewhere past Venus, but it had been Sengupta who'd planted thermite along those seams just 6 hours ago. There wasn't much bulkhead to spare, so Sengupta, still unwilling to let consensus into her head, had stripped the tool rack bare and slathered smart paint across the gecko boards.
The microfibers fuzzed the image a little at high res, but the space was big enough to contain the windows she needed. Radar profiles and trajectory overlays, engine vitals, throttles and brakes in shades of gold and emerald. A naked-eye view of Moore's last ace up the sleeve, still posing a little too convincingly as decommissioned junk, swelling slowly against the deceptively blue-green crescent of a world falling into ever greater depths of disrepair. In a dedicated window, stage right, Valerie, still tied to the mast. She hadn't moved in weeks, and yet there was still a vague sense of lethality in that frozen body, a sense of something spring-loaded and biding its time. Its remaining time, measured in minutes now. A gentle nudge, a slow, steady pressure pushed Brooks against the side of the alcove. Over on the tool rack, the Crown's avatar turned 180 ponderous degrees around its center of mass and coasted onto retrograde. "Hang on," Sengupta warned, and hit the brakes. Mutilated, amputated, cauterized, the ship groaned and ground down the Delta V. Deceleration pushed Brooks against the floor of his alcove. He staggered. The harness held him up against this final encore performance of down. Moore touched some unseen control, and out across the vacuum, his chameleon satellite split at the seams like an exploding schematic. Solar panels and radiator vanes came apart in puffs of vapor turned instantly to snow. The shell fell apart as if drawn and quartered. Body parts sailed silently in all directions. A great arrowhead, aimed at the earth, floated exposed where the false skin had come apart. It glinted in the rising sun, its stubby wings iridescent as a dragonfly's. Flying debris rattled across the Crown's hull like a hail of pebbles. Moore waited until the shower had passed and hit the switch. Cracks of sunlight ignited around the hatch. The barrier there, welded shut, burned open and fell away. The hatch beyond dilated in an instant. A brief hurricane pulled the plating into space, and Brooks toward the stars. The webbing held him fast for the moment it took Moore to snap the buckles. Then they were through, and into a void silent but for the sound of fast, harsh breathing, just this side of panic, filling Brooks's helmet. The dark earth spread out below, too convex for mere landscape, too vast and imminent to be a sphere. Weather systems laid dirty fingerprints across its face. Coastlines and continents shone like galaxies where civilization burned bright, flickered dull, and intermittent orange where it had burned out. It was such a long way down. Sunlight turned the flotsam ahead into a blinding jigsaw, save for one brief instant when a great dark hand passed over the sun. Brooks flailed and turned to see the Crown of Thorns in passing, still huge in the sky, backlit against a risen sun and a bright, spreading crescent. Her last frozen breath sparkled near the bow, like a faint cloud of jewels. He could not see Valerie's hiding place from here. Something yanked at his leash. Brooks spun to heel, to the shuttle swelling in his sights and its cloud of debris.
"Focus,"
Moore hissed, overcome. "Sorry." They tumbled forward, Moore in the lead, the others dragged behind. The shuttle's hatch gaped just behind the wraparound cockpit window, like a frog's eardrum cut away and folded back against the head. Some magical spray-on ablative made the hull shimmer with oily rainbows. A faint static of ice crystals whispered across Brooks's helmet. Then Moore was on the hull, dead on target. Boots coming down between the edge of the hatch and a convenient handhold welded like a towel bar to the shuttle's skin. His legs bent to absorb the impact. One gloved hand seized the handhold as if it had eyes of its own. Brooks sailed past overhead and splatted against the fuselage. He bounced, spun against the tether, grasped wildly at the recessed cone of some dormant maneuvering thruster just a few centimeters out of reach, finally felt his boots click home against the hull. The Crown was well past and well below them now, drifting in a slow, majestic tumble toward the Terminator. Forward momentum stalled, decelerating from the endless satellite fall around to the terminal incendiary fall into. Distance and the limits of vision had healed its scars. Now, torn apart, spliced back together, burned and broken, she looked almost pristine. You kept us alive, Brooks thought. And then, I'm sorry. Moore yanked him out of one moment and into the next, reeling Brooks and Sengupta in together like a fish on a line. Brooks spared a moment to envy the pilot's composure. She hadn't made a sound, hadn't even breathed hard during their fall across the endless chasm. Only now, peering into her faceplate, did he see her lips move below tightly clenched eyelids. Only now, bumped helmet to helmet, could he hear her incantation.
Oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck! You little chicken shit, you turned off your comm.
Moore bundled her through the open hatch. Brooks followed, pulling himself into the cabin. Two racks, one behind the other, each holding six acceleration couches like a half dozen eggs in the carton. The couches themselves were squashed nearly flat, each bent just enough at the ass and the knees to avoid being classified as cots. The racks faced forward toward a pair of more conventional command chairs and a control horseshoe. Above those controls, a visor of quartz glass ran around the front of the cockpit. No stars shone in that nose-down view. The world filled it from side to side, mostly dark, brightening to starboard. That was pretty much it. One hatch in the aft bulkhead and a smaller one on the deck, both sealed. The first might have led to a cargo hold, a very modest one, given the size of the vessel. But that hole in the deck couldn't have led to anything more spacious than a service crawlway. Contingency orbital extraction, Moore had said. Emergency planetfall for soldiers stranded in the wake of failed missions. This wasn't a shuttle. It was a glorified parachute to be used once and thrown away. Moore had sealed the hatch and pushed himself into one of the command chairs. Sengupta, recovered from her brief catatonia, fumbled into the other. Brooks strapped himself into one of the hamburger racks behind as their ride booted up. Outside, sounds came back to him, faint as a whisper at first, barely audible above the breath of his helmet regulator and the murmured recitation of pre-flight checklists coming over comm. The hiss of compressed gas, tiny clicks and beeps, muffled as if under pillows, the snap of ancient switches in their sockets.
70 kPa, HUD reported. He unsealed his visor and slid it back, cold as a glacier in his lungs, the taste of plastic monomers at the back of his throat. Breathable, though.
Moore twisted against his straps, couldn't quite turn to line of sight.
Better keep that down. This bird's been up here a while. Could be some leaks.
For the first time, Brooks focused his attention on the dashboard. Single-function LEDs. Rows of manual switches big enough for hands wrapped in mylar and urethane. Tactical displays, trapped in embedded panes of crystal, instead of flowing freely across whatever real estate the moment required. He brought his visor back down.
This thing is ancient!
Moore grunted over the comm.
Older it is, the better the odds everyone's forgotten about it.
We've traded one derelict for another. Past the viewport, something flared in the corner of Brooks's eye. Sunlight bouncing off a piece of orbital debris, maybe. Or perhaps the thrusters of some distant ship. But it burned too long for one, and too low for the other, and the wrong color for either. When he turned to face it, squinting against the sun, he could almost swear he saw the core inside the contrail. A dark, jagged patchwork coming apart in a line of fire, etching its way across the face of the planet. Sticks and bones, turning to ash.
There she goes,
Moore said softly, and Brooks wasn't quite sure whether he meant the monster or the machine.
Ignition,
Sengupta said, as they too began to fall.
The crown burned cleanly. Nothing escaped. No space-suited figure roused itself at the last moment to leap miraculously free of the hull, although Sengupta's camera watched it until the end. A limb may have twitched just before the feed died, a brief flicker of consciousness passing through a body, just long enough to sense that something had gone wrong with its best-laid plans. But even that could have been a trick of the light. The anticlimax left a guilty lump in Brooks's throat, The ease with which they'd murdered Valerie somehow made her less of a threat in hindsight, stole the justification from their crime. He barely remembered their descent, frictional incandescence flickering across the windshield like sheet lightning, static hissing on every channel until he remembered to shut down his radio. Fragments, really, disconnected images. At some point, weight returned, stronger and steadier than it had been for 100 years. Racks and acceleration couches and a lone cockroach folded up into conventional sitting positions against a vibrating deck that Brooks could finally perceive as a floor. Then they were gliding in a wide spiral over a steely gray ocean, and the sun had dropped back below the horizon. Something listed on the seascape below, glimpsed in split-second snatches as it slipped back and forth across the windshield. A half-submerged jump ramp for water skiers, a flooded parking lot, the disembodied corner of an aircraft carrier, flickering with St. Elmo's fire. Brooks got no sense of scale from this altitude, and after a few moments, the ocean dropped from sight as Sengupta lifted the nose for final approach. Something kicked them hard from behind, threw Brooks forward against the harness, and brought the nose down with a slap. Walls of white spray geysered just past the port, split down the center line. An instant later, the view shattered and dissolved behind sheets of water running down the quartz. Something punched the shuttle under the chin. It bucked back and screamed along its length like an eviscerated banshee. Now they were climbing again. Now they were slowing. Now they were still. Sheets of water contracted to runnels, to droplets. The shuttle squinted past them to a few fading stars in a steel sky. Way off to the left, almost past line of sight, something flickered in and out of view, like a half-remembered dream. Some kind of antennae, perhaps, a wire-frame tree. Moore dislocated his helmet and let it roll to the deck.
Here we are.
Someone had carved a landing strip out of thin air. It hung 4 or 5 meters above the waves, a scorched, scarred tongue of alloy with the shuttle at its tip. It extended back to solid land, like some kind of absurd diving board. Except the substrate wasn't land, and it wasn't solid. It emerged from the ocean as gradually as a seashore. Electric blue sidewinders writhed and sparked along the waterline, followed the swells as they surged up and down the slope. The surface seemed gray as cement in the pre-dawn half-light, and almost as featureless, except for the scored tracks the shuttle had left. But while it rose from the sea as unremarkably as a boat ramp at one end, it did not subside or drop off or reimmerse at the other. It just faded away. A massive slab of listing alloy, big as a parking lot, segueing from solid, undeniable opacity to spectral translucence, to nothing at all, over a distance of maybe a meter and a half. Except for this runway, freshly sculpted by the screaming friction of a hot landing. Moore had already shed his spacesuit and was standing on thin air, 10 meters ahead of the grounded shuttle. Bitter gray swells marched past below his feet. Every couple of seconds, a wireframe structure flickered into existence nearby, towering 6 meters over his head and infested with parabolic antennae. Brooks leaned out the hatch and took it all in. The frigid Pacific wind blew through his jumpsuit as though he were naked. The earth pulled at him with a force he'd almost forgotten. His arms, bracing him against the bulkhead, seemed made of rubber. Sengupta poked him from behind.
Hurry up, Roach, you never seen chromatophores before?
In fact, he had. Croaks were basically just a subspecies of smart paint, but he'd never encountered one on this scale before.
How big is this thing?
Pretty small, only a click across. Look, you want to get off before the damn thing sinks the rest of the way?
He squatted, grabbed the lip of the hatch, clambered overboard. Gravity almost tipped him on the landing, but he managed to keep his feet under him, stood swaying, with one hand braced against the hull, still warm enough for discomfort, even after being soaked by an ocean. This close to the shuttle, the cloak had been thoroughly scored away, but a half-dozen uncertain steps took him onto a substrate clearer than glass. He looked down onto a wave-tossed sea,
and fought the urge to flail his arms. Instead, he walked carefully toward Mor as Sengupta climbed down behind him. Flickering orange light caught his eye as he rounded the nose of the shuttle, fire in the near distance, a guttering line of flames atop an incongruous, levitating patch of scorched earth. Brooks could make out superstructures silhouetted there, low, flat-topped rectangles, a radio dome cracked open like an eggshell, the barely visible crosshatch of railings and fence posts against the fire. Maybe something moving, ant-size with distance. Not your average Jyland, this. Not a refugee camp or a city-state. No iffy commercial venture with a taste for the forgiving regulatory climate of international waters. This was a place for Mor and his kind. A staging ground for covert military actions. A lookout on the high seas, patrolling the whole northern gyre. Clandestine. Not clandestine enough, apparently. He shivered at Moore's shoulder. What happened here? The colonel shrugged.
Something convenient.
How so?
It's been abandoned. We won't have to talk our way in.
Is it still plugged in? What if it... Mor shook his head.
Shouldn't be a problem. Nobody who'd have done this would care about heaven.
He pointed at the distant flames.
That way.
Brooks turned as Sengupta came up behind them. The shuttle cooled in the background, half-melted ablative, oozing like candle wax around its belly. Huh, he remarked. I'd have thought there'd be, you know, landing gear.
Too expensive,
Mor told him.
Everything's disposable.
You got that right. A halting, freezing hike up a shallow slope. A walk on the water. An invisible bridge to the visible tip of a derelict iceberg. Gutted structures spread out before them like little pieces of Gehenna. Some still aflame, others merely smoldering. Finally, they reached the visible edge of that levitating island. Little more than a patina of black, greasy soot floating in midair. It was still a relief to see something underfoot. It was a greater relief to stop and catch his breath. Mor laid a sudden hand on his shoulder. Sengupta said, "Wah?" and fell silent. Ahead, barely visible through a curtain of oily smoke, things moved. They'd arrived at what had once been some kind of air traffic hub, a low-slung control shack whose walls and roof came together in a wraparound band of soot-stained windows angled at the sky. Two dead helicopters and a one-winged jump jet littered a scorched expanse of tarmac and landing bullseyes, barely visible beneath the scoring. The nozzles of retracted fuel lines poked through the deck here and there. One burned fitfully, a monstrous candle, or a fuse set to detonate whatever reservoir fed the flame. In the middle of it all, bodies moved. The bodies were human. Their movements were anything but. Mor waved the others back against the shack, spared a backward glance and a raised hand. Stay here. Brooks nodded. Mor slipped around the corner and disappeared. A swirling gust blew sparks and acrid smoke into Brooks's face. He suppressed a cough, eyes stinging, and squinted through the haze. Human, yes. Two, maybe three, near the edge of one of the bullseyes. Gray coveralls, blue uniform, insignia impossible to make out from this distance. They were dancing. At least that was the closest word Brooks could summon to describe the tableau. Movements both inhumanly precise and inhumanly fast. Humanoid simulacra engaged in some somatic call and response unlike anything he'd ever seen. There was a lead, but it kept changing. There were steps, but they never seemed to repeat. It was ballet. It was semaphore. It was some kind of conversation that engaged every part of the body except the tongue. It was utterly silent, but for the machine gun staccato of boots on the deck, faint and intermittent through the soft roar of the wind and the crackling of the flames. And faintly familiar somehow. Mor ended it all with a blow to the back of the head.
One moment, the dancing marionettes were alone on the stage. The next, the colonel had materialized from the smoke, his hand already blurring toward the target. The gray-clad dancer jerked and thrashed and collapsed, twitching onto the deck. A disconnected puppet gone suddenly grand mal. The other threw himself down at the same instant, although Moore hadn't touched him. He lay twisting beside his fallen partner, still in frantic clockwork motion, but only twitching now. Amplitude reined in to complement these new and unexpected steps brought so suddenly into the routine.
Echopraxia, echo-fucking-praxia, Sengupta hissed at his shoulder.
Moore was back.
This way.
A broken door gaped around the corner. Inside, brain-dead smart paint sparked and sizzled along those few control surfaces that hadn't already been put to the flame. Brooks glanced over his shoulder.
What about...
They're in a feedback loop. We don't have to worry until the mechanic comes back.
A companionway gaped from the far bulkhead. A fallen cabinet blocked the way. Moore pushed it aside.
Isn't that bad for them?
Brooks wondered, and immediately felt like an idiot.
I mean, wouldn't it be better if we broke the loop? Split them up?
Moore paused at the top of the stairs.
Best case scenario. They'd do as well as you would if someone split you down the middle.
Oh. After a moment. Worst case?
They wake up, Moore said, and come after us.
If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. Neil Peart. They came across a sloping commons area, dark and derelict, but for a cone of emergency light spilling in from the corridor and a smattering of icons winking fitfully from the far bulkhead. A row of comm cubbies, snoozing until some lonely grunt chose to phone home or eavesdrop on the happening world. They could only access Main Street. No windows into anything that might require security clearance. But consensus and purse comm links floated free to one and all, serenely untroubled by whatever small apocalypse that had taken out the upper deck. Moore moved on in search of greater privilege and darker secrets. Sengupta hung around long enough to make sure the links were solid before disappearing in his wake. Brooks sat in the leaning darkness and did not move.
What do I say to her? What do I say? Hey, you know how Icarus went away and world fell apart? Funny story. You know how we thought there was no God? Well, it's worse than you think. Hi, honey. I'm home.
He took a deep breath.
This is a stupid idea. We're way past this. I should just catch up with the others.
Let it out again.
Someone has to tell her. She needs to know.
He felt the corners of his mouth pull back in a grimace of self-loathing.
This isn't even about her. This is about Dan Brooks and his imploding worldview. This is about running back to the only person who ever gave you any shred of comfort, whether you deserved it or not.
He sacked the interface. He tried four times before the system could even find the address. The lump in his throat grew with each attempt. The Quinternet was falling apart. Everything was. But it had deep roots, old roots reaching back over a century, a design both completely uncephalized and massively redundant. Functionality, in the face of overwhelming entropy, had been built into its DNA from the start. Link established. Welcome to Heaven. Timmins franchise. Visitor's lobby.
Still there. Still online. Still alive.
He hadn't entirely believed it.
Rona McLennan, November 13, 2086.
Pinging.
Please pick up. Pinging. Please be busy. Pinging. Dan. Oh, God. Here she is. I must be dreaming. Hi, Ro. I wondered where you'd got off to. Things have been so confused out there lately.
She was a voice in the darkness, distant, disembodied. there was no visual. I'm sorry I haven't been in touch.
I wasn't expecting you to get in touch.
Maybe there was warmth in her voice now. Wry amusement, at least.
When was the last time you dropped by?
You didn't want me to drop by.
You said... I said I wasn't going to come back out, love. I said I didn't want you to spend all our time together trying to change my mind.
He didn't say anything.
I'm glad you did come by,
she said after a while.
It's good to see you.
I can't see you, he said softly.
Dan, what would be the point?
He shook his head.
Is it important? I could show you something, if that would make it any easier.
Ro, you can't stay in there.
I'm not having this argument again, Dan. This is not the same argument. Things have changed. I know. I'm in heaven, not Andromeda. I can see everything out there that I want to. Upheaval, rebellion, environmental collapse. Plus ça change.
It's a lot worse since Icarus went down.
Yeah,
she said slowly.
Icarus.
Everything's stretched to the breaking point. There are outages and brownouts everywhere you look. Took me 4 tries to even find you. Did you know that? And heaven's hardly the most obscure address on the planet. The whole network's forgetting things.
Dan, it's been forgetting things for ages. That's why we call it the SplinterNet.
I didn't know you called it that, he said, vaguely surprised.
How is an elephant like a schizophrenic?
What?
An elephant never forgets.
He said nothing.
That's an AI joke,
she said after a while. Could be the worst one I've ever heard.
I've got a million of them. You sure you want me to come back out?
More than ever.
But really, how long do you think you could stay sane if you remembered everything you'd ever experienced? It's good to forget, no matter what kind of network you are. It's not a breakdown, it's an adaptation.
That's bullshit, Ro. Losing network addresses is a good thing? What's next? The voltage protocols? What happens when the grid forgets to shunt power to Timmins?
There are risks, she said gently. I get it. The backups could fail. The realists could strike. The airheads probably still want me for war crimes just on general principles, and I can't say I really blame them. Every day in here could be my last. And how's that any different from life out there?
Some tiny lens sent her the sight of Daniel Brooks opening his mouth. She rushed on, preempting him.
I'll tell you, I don't have anything anyone could want. I'm not a threat to anyone. My footprint's a tiny fraction of yours, even factoring in your kink for spending so much time in tents. I can experience literally everything in here that you can out there, and a billion other things besides. Oh. And one other thing.
She paused some precise number of milliseconds.
I don't have to kill intelligent beings to pay the rent. Nobody's saying you'd have to. Now let's look out there, shall we? Infectious zombieism running rampant in at least 20 countries I know of. Realists and rearguard Catholics taking shots at any heretics they can lay their crosshairs on. Food poisoning on the rise for anyone who can't afford a consumables-class printer. They haven't even bothered tracking species extinction rates for a decade now. And have you heard about that new weaponized echopraxia that's going around? Jitterbug, they call it. Used to be pure monkey-see-monkey-do, but they say it's mutating. Now you get to die dancing. Bring a friend along for the ride.
The difference, he said grimly, is that when the power fails out here, you can curl up under a blanket. If it fails in heaven, you're brain dead in 5 minutes. You're helpless in there, Rona, and it's all just a house of cards waiting for... She didn't answer. He couldn't finish.
He wondered how much she'd changed already, how much of her remained behind that gentle, utterly unyielding and unreal voice. Was he even talking to an intact brain, or to some hybrid emulation of neurons and arsenide? How much of his wife had been replaced over the past 2 years? That incremental cannibalism, that ongoing fossilization of flesh by minerals. It had always scared the living shit out of him. And she embraced it. "I've seen things," he told her. "World-shaking things. We all have. It's a shaky world. Will you just shut up and listen to me? I'm not talking about the goddamned news feeds. I'm talking about things that... I've seen things that... I know why you went away now, you know? I finally get it. I never did before, but right now I swear I'd join you in a second if I could. But I can't. It doesn't feel like transcendence to me. It doesn't feel like rising into some better world. It feels like being replaced. I mean, I can't even stand to have a consensus augment in my head. It's like anything that changes what I am kills what I am. Do you understand? Of course. You're scared. He nodded miserably. You've always been scared, Dan. As long as I've known you. You've spent your whole life being an asshole just to keep people from finding out. Lucky for you, I could see through it, hmm? He said nothing. Know what else I see? He didn't. He didn't have a clue. That's what makes you brave.
It took a moment for that to sink in.
What? You think I don't know? Why you keep mouthing off to the wrong people? Why you sabotaged your own career every step of the way? Why you can't help but face off against anybody who has any power over you?
Climbing an endless ladder toward a hungry monster. Charging into a leg-hold labyrinth with living walls. Biting the head off a girl half his size when she told him he couldn't go home. Maybe not such a proud moment, that last one.
You're saying I overcame my fear, he began. I'm saying you gave in to it, every time. You're so scared of being seen as a coward, you'd jump off a cliff just to prove you weren't. You think I never saw it? I was your wife, for God's sake. I saw your knees knocking every time you stood up to the schoolyard bully and got your teeth kicked in for your troubles. Your whole damn life has been one unending act of overcompensation. And you know something, love? It's just as well. Because people need to stand up now and then. And who else is going to?
It didn't sink in at first. All he could do was frown and replay and try to figure out when the conversation had switched tracks like that.
That has to be the most heartwarming definition of asshole I've ever heard, he said at last.
I liked it.
He shook his head.
It doesn't matter, though. I still can't follow you.
Follow me.
Her voice was flat with sudden insight.
You think?
She won't come out. And I can't go in.
Dan.
A window opened on the wall.
Look at me.
He looked away. He looked back. He saw something that resembled a pickled fetus more than it did a grown woman. He saw arms and legs drawn close against the body in defiance of the cuffs at wrists and ankles, of the contractile microtubes that pulled them straight 3 times a day in a rearguard battle against atrophy and the shortening of tendons. He saw a shriveled face and a hairless scalp and a million carbon fibers sprouting from the base of the skull, floating like a nimbus around her head.
This is not what I'm talking about,
something said with her voice, and her lips did not move.
Rona, why are you? You call this change, but it isn't,
the voice said.
Heaven isn't the future. It's a refuge for gutless wonders who want to hide from the future. A nature preserve for people who can't adapt. It's wish fulfillment for passenger pigeons. You think I was lording this over you? This is nothing but a dumping ground for useless also-rans. You don't belong here.
Useless? Brooks blinked, stunned.
Ro, don't ever. I ran away. I threw in the towel years ago. But you may be doing everything for the wrong reasons, and you may be pissing yourself when you do it, but at least you haven't given up. You could be hiding with the rest of us, but you're out there in a world with no reset button, a place you have no control over, a place where other people can take your whole life's work and twist it to such horrible ends, and there's no way to ever take back what they did.
Rona, what?
I know, Dan. Of course I know. You didn't have to hide it from me. You couldn't hide it from me. I'm more plugged in than you are.
The voice was gentle and kind, and still the face of that thing did not move.
The moment they quarantined Bridgeport, I knew. I almost called you then. I thought maybe you'd finally give up and come inside, but...
A mountain smashed into the back of his skull. His forehead smacked the wall of the cubby, rebounded. He toppled backward in his chair and sprawled across the deck. A redshifted galaxy ignited, pulsing in his head. Light years away, an upside-down giant stood silhouetted in the doorway. He blinked, moaned, tried to focus. The star field dimmed, the roaring in his head faded a little. The giant shrank down to merely life-size. Its depths were so black, they almost glowed. Rakshi Sengupta, meet Backdoor Brooks. Somewhere, far away, a computer called out in the voice of his dead wife. Brooks tried to bring his hand to his head. Sengupta stomped on it and leaned over him. Fresh pain erupted off the midline and shot up his arm.
I want you to imagine something, you fucking roach!
Sengupta's fingers danced and dipped overhead.
Oh, God, no, Brooks thought dully. Not you, too.
He let his head loll to the side, let his eyes stray somewhere, anywhere else. Sengupta kicked him in the head and made him pay attention. Her fingers clenched and interlaced and bent backwards so far he thought they'd break.
Want you to imagine Christ on the cross?
He was barely even surprised when the spasms started. Sengupta leaned in to admire her handiwork. Even now she could not look at his face.
Oh, yes, I have been waiting for this. I have been working for this. I have...
A sound, sharp, short, loud. Sengupta fell instantly silent, stood up. A dark stain bloomed on her left breast. She collapsed onto Brooks like a rag doll. They lay there a moment. Cheek to cheek, like slow-dancing lovers. She coughed, tried to rise, sprawled downhill to Brooks's side. Her dimming eyes focused, unfocused, settled finally on some point near the hatch. Jim Moore stood there like a statue, his eyes so full of grief they might as well have been dead already. Something crossed Sengupta's face in that moment. Not happiness, not quite. Not surprise. Enlightenment, maybe. After a moment, for the very first time, she looked Dan Brooks straight in the eye.
Oh, fuck,
she whispered as her eyes went out.
Are you ever screwed?
I know it doesn't make any sense,
Moore was saying, turning the gun over in his hands.
We were never close. That may have been my fault, I suppose. Although, you know, he wasn't what you'd call an easy child.
He'd pulled up a chair, sat hunched and leaning against the slant, with his knees on his elbows, the light from the corridor catching him in quarter profile. Brooks lay on the floor while Sengupta's blood pooled against his side. It soaked through his clothing, stuck his jumpsuit to his ribs. His head throbbed. His throat was parched. He tried to swallow, was relieved and a bit surprised to find that he could.
Now, though, he's half a light year away, and for the first time in his life I feel that we're actually able to talk.
Pale nebulae clouded Sengupta's open eyes. Brooks could see them clearly, even in this dim light. Could even turn his head a little to bring them into proper focus. Not Valerie's best-laid glitch. Not the total paralysis the vampire had layered down with weeks of graffiti and subtle gesticulation. Or at least, not the same precision in the trigger stimulus. It probably was the same program. The same chain of photons to mirror neurons to motor nerves, still dozing in the back of his head should anyone sound the call to arms. Sengupta must have just improvised after the fact, gone back over old footage, figured out the basic moves, and acted them out as best she could.
It's as though he knew I'd be listening all those months ago, as though he knew what I'd be thinking when his words arrived.
She probably hadn't even been planning for Vendetta. It had probably been just another pattern-matching puzzle to keep that hyperactive brain occupied, fortuitously available, when it turned out that her wife's murderer and her adopted roach were one and the same. This rigor was half-assed and short-lived. He could feel it in his tendons. The tightness was already beginning to subside. Still pretty impressive, though.
I feel closer to Ciri than I ever did when we were on the same planet,
Moore said. He leaned forward, assessed the living and the dead.
Does that make any sense to you?
Brooks tried to move his tongue. It barely trembled against the palate. He focused on moving his lips. A sound emerged, a groan. It contained nothing but frustration and distress.
I know, Moore agreed. And at first it felt more like just reports, you know? Letters home, but full of facts. About the mission. I listened to that signal. Oh, I would have listened forever, even if all he'd ever done was tell the tale. I learned so much about the boy. So much I never suspected.
Take two.
Jim. And then it changed. As though he ran out of facts and had nothing left but feelings. He stopped the reportage and started talking to me.
Jim. Rock, she thought.
I can even hear him now, Daniel. That's the remarkable thing. The signal's so weak it shouldn't even be able to penetrate the atmosphere, especially with all the broadband chatter going on. And yet, I can hear him, right here in the room.
Rakshi thought, your zombie switch.
I think he's trying to warn me about something.
You might have been hacked.
Something about you.
She said you might not be in control.
Moore stopped turning the gun in his hands, looked down at it. Brooks fired every command he could along every motor nerve in his body. His fingers wiggled. Moore smiled a sad little smile.
Nobody's in control, Daniel. Do you really think you don't have one of these zombie switches in your own head? You don't think everyone does? We're all just along for the ride. It's the coming of the Lord is what it is. God's on its way. It's the angels of the asteroids, calling the shots.
Angels again. Divine teleoperators. Powerful creatures with neither soul nor will. God's sock puppets. Jim Moore was turning into one before his eyes.
What if it's not Ciri?
Brooks managed. His tongue seemed to be thawing a bit.
What if it's something else?
The colonel smiled again.
You don't think I'd know my own son?
It knows your son, Jim.
Of course it knows him. It mutilated him. Can't you remember the goddamn slideshow?
It knows Ciri, and Ciri knows you, and it's smart, Jim. It's so fucking smart.
So are you.
Moore eyed him curiously.
Smarter than you let on, anyway.
If only. He wasn't smart enough to get out of this. not smart enough to outthink some interstellar demon who could hack a man's brain across 5 trillion kilometers in a 6-month time lag, who could trickle its own parasitic subroutines into the host's head and lead him around in real time. Assuming that Moore hadn't just gone batshit crazy on his own, of course. That was probably the most parsimonious explanation. Not that it mattered. Brooks wasn't smart enough to get out of that, either. Moore lowered his eyes.
I didn't want to do that, you know. She was a good person. She was just misguided. I suppose I may have overreacted. I only did it to protect you.
Behind him, up among the crossbeams that ribbed the ceiling, one shadow stirred among others. Brooks blinked, and it was gone.
I wonder if that was such a good idea.
It was, Brooks croaked. Really, it...
Faster than he could finish, a shape detached itself from the ceiling, swayed silently against the light, and folded down over Moore like a praying mantis. Inhuman fingers, blurred in motion, silhouetted lips in motion. Without any fuss at all, Moore stopped moving. Valerie dropped soundlessly to the deck, crossed the room, stared down at Daniel Brooks as he slowly, painfully bent one knee. It was the closest thing to fight flight left in him. She bent close and whispered,
"The tomb at Arimathea."
His body unlocked. He gulped air. The vampire stood, stepped back, gave him a small, cryptic smile. Brooks swallowed.
"Saw you burn," he managed.
"Twice."
She didn't even dignify it with an answer. "We expect a trick, and we find one. We pat ourselves in the back. We find her pinned to the hull. Think we do, anyway. And just stop looking. Of course she's out there. There she is. There goes her hab and all its tripwires. Why look any further? Why look inside the crown? Why check the hatches in the shuttle?" He propped himself up on his elbows, the sodden jumpsuit peeled from the deck as if steeped in half-set epoxy. Valerie watched impassively as he got to his feet. "So what now? You give me a 10-second head start to make it sport it?" A blur and a hiss, and he was off his feet, strangling and kicking a meter from the deck with her hand around his throat. In the next instant, he was back on the floor, collapsed in a heap while Valerie grinned down with far too many teeth.
"All this experience," she remarked
while he gasped for breath,
"and you're still an idiot."
Catch and release, cat and mouse, just having fun, he supposed, in her way.
"Aircraft are all dead," Valerie said. "I find a ride in the moon pool, though. Get us to the mainland, at least."
"Us," Brooks said.
"Swim, if you'd rather, or stay."
She dropped her chin in the direction of the statue frozen on its chair.
"If you stay, you should kill him, though. Or he kills you when he unlocks."
"He's my friend. He protected me before..."
"Only part of him. OS conflict. It resolves soon enough. It's resolving now."
Valerie turned toward the door.
"Don't wait too long. He's on a mission from God."
She stepped into the light. Brooks looked back at his friend. Jim Moore sat staring at the floor, face unreadable. He blinked, very slowly, as Brooks watched. He did not cry out against his abandonment. Brooks followed the monster along slanting corridors and companionways, down endless flights of emergency-lit stairs, into the bowels of the Gyland, unto its very anus, an airlock that would have felt too small at 5 times the size, given present company. The chamber beyond echoed like a cave, and looked a little like one too. Pipes and hoses and cylinders of compressed gas jutted like stalactites from the angled ceiling. The room was half underwater. The ocean had breached the banks of the moon pool as the Gyland listed, flooded down to some temporary equilibrium halfway up the far bulkhead. Diffuse gray-green light filtered up from outside and wriggled dimly across every surface. It was only a small port in the storm. There was probably a bay big enough to dock a kraken or a swordfish somewhere else on this floating behemoth. But here, the berths were for smaller vehicles. A dozen parking racks hung from an overhead conveyor train, most of them empty. A two-person midwater scout rested snugly in one clenched set of grappling claws, the end of a service crane still embedded in its shattered crystal snout. Another dangled precariously from the ceiling, nose submerged, tail entangled in its broken perch. A third, apparently intact, floated just off the flooded deck. Broad shark body, whale's flat flukes, the great saucer eyes of some mesopelagic hatchetfish bridging the snout. Aspidontus, according to the letters edged just above the countershade line. It bumped gently against the edge of the moon pool, tail to the bulkhead, nose poking out over the hole in the floor, a waist-deep wade down the flooded incline. A fucking cold wade, as it turned out. Valerie leapt the distance from a standing start, sailed over Brooks's head, and landed one step from the hatch. The vessel dipped and rolled under the impact. She didn't even wobble. By the time Brooks had dragged his soaking legs and shriveled testicles onto the hull, she was inside, and the little sub was humming awake. Three seats. Brooks dropped into shotgun, pulled the hatch down overhead, dogged it. Valerie tapped the dashboard. Aspidontus shook herself, thrashed her flukes, humped forward, half-stranded over loose canisters and bits of broken podmates. She hung balanced for a moment, belly scraping the submerged edge of the pool. Her flukes slapped the water like a dolphin's, and she was free. Still dark overhead, though, for all the hours that must have passed since sunrise. The derelict Gyland loomed above them like the belly of a mountain, all too visible from underneath, ready to drop down and squash them flat without warning. There was nothing beyond the cockpit, no fish, no plankton swarms, no sun-dappled waves sending shafts of light dancing through the water, not even the indestructible drifts of immortal plastic debris so ubiquitous from pole to pole. Nothing but heavy blackness above, and dim green murk everywhere else. And Aspidontus, a speck embedded in glass. And where to now? He wondered. Why did I even come along? Why did she even take me? What am I to this thing, other than a walking lunch? How the hell did I ever decide that Jim Moore was less dangerous than a goddamn vampire? But he knew it was a meaningless question. It was predicated on the assumption that the decision had ever been his to begin with. Darkness receded above and crouched from below. Aspidontus was diving. 100 meters. 150. They were in the middle of the Pacific. The seabed was 4 kilometers down. There was nothing in between, unless Valerie had arranged a rendezvous with another submarine. 200 meters. Aspidontus leveled off. Right. Beneath the thermocline. Stealthed to sonar. The vessel angled to port. Valerie hadn't touched the controls since they'd left the surface. She'd probably given the sub its marching orders, while Dan Brooks had been pleading with a brain in a tank. The course was laid out right there on the dashboard. A faint golden thread wound along the eastern North Pacific. The viewing angle was bad, though. Too small, too many contours. He could not make out the details. He knew where he'd have chosen to go. This had all started in the desert. The bicamerals had manipulated him onto their goddamn chessboard for reasons of their own, and if they'd ever planned on letting him in on the joke, Portia and Valerie had taken them out of the game before they'd had the chance. But the bicamerals were legion, and not all of them had been burned on the altar. If there were answers to be had, the Hive would have them. He leaned sideways until the roadmap angled into clearer view, grunted to himself, completely unsurprised. Valerie stared into the abyss and said nothing. She'd laid in a course for the Oregon coast. Prophet. There are people here who repeatedly drown themselves in the name of enlightenment. They climb into glass coffins called prisms, seal the lid, and open the spigot until they're completely submerged. Sometimes they leave a bubble of air at the top, barely big enough to stick their noses into. Other times, not even that much. This is not suicide, although occasional deaths have been reported. They would tell you that it is exactly the opposite, that you haven't lived until you've nearly died. But there's more to this than the superficial thrill-seeking of the adrenaline junkie. The prismatic kink derives from the evolutionary underpinnings of consciousness itself. Put your hand in an open flame, and subconscious reflex will snatch it back long before you're even aware of the pain. It is only when some other agenda is in conflict, your hand hurts but you don't want to spill the contents of a hot serving tray all over your clean rug, that the self awakens and decides which impulse to obey. Long before art and science and philosophy arose, consciousness had but one function, not to merely implement motor commands, but to mediate between commands in opposition. In a submerged body starving for air, it's difficult to imagine two imperatives more opposed than the need to breathe and the need to hold your breath. As one prismatic told me, put yourself in one of those things and tell me you aren't more intensely conscious than you've ever been in your life. The fetish, it seems grandiose to call it a movement, would itself seem to be the manifestation of an opposing impulse, a reaction against something. By all accounts, drowning is an intensely unpleasant experience, although I did not take my interviewee up on her offer. It's difficult to imagine what kind of stimulus might provoke such intense pushback, why the need to assert one's consciousness of all things would seem so pressing. None of the prismatics I asked were able to cast any light on this question. They simply didn't think of their actions in those terms. It's just important to know who you are, one 28-year-old tatmaster told me after a few moments' thought, but his words seemed as much question as answer. Heath Honeyborn, 2080, travels with my aunt, a baseline guide to imminent obsolescence. Monsters give us courage to change the things we can. They are our primal fears given form, terrible predators who can be vanquished if only we rise to the challenge. Gods give us serenity to accept the things we can't. They exist to explain floods and earthquakes and all that which lies beyond our control. It did not surprise me in the least to learn that vampires do not believe in monsters. I'll admit, their belief in gods was a bit of a surprise. David Nickel. Deep in the Oregon desert, crazy as a prophet, Daniel Brooks opened his eyes to the usual accumulation of wreckage. The monastery lay in ruins. The broad stone steps of the main entrance sloped away before him, cracked and fissured, but still intact for the most part. Past them, to the left of some small patch of desert mysteriously slagged to glass, his tent shivered in the morning breeze. He'd salvaged it from across the valley. He must have, along with his supplies and his equipment, although he wasn't quite sure when. But he could barely remember the last time he'd slept there. Too constraining somehow. The sky made a better ceiling. These days he didn't use the tent for much more than storage. He stood and stretched, felt his joints crack as the sun peeked through a gap in the fallen stonework behind him. He turned and surveyed his domain. One end of the monastery stood reasonably intact. The other was a tumble-down pile of broken stone. The damage had been inflicted along a gradient, as though entropy were slowly devouring the structure from north to south. Entropy had left a path, though, a small canyon through the rubble, leading back to the garden. The parts of the lawn that hadn't been buried outright were brown and brittle and long dead, except for a small green patch struggling bravely around one of the bicameral washbasin pedestals. That pedestal, blessed with some kind of magic, was intact and unmarked by the devastation that had rained down everywhere else. The basin even held half an aliquot of stagnant water. Blazing noon or frozen midnight, the level never changed. Some kind of capillary action, probably. A core of porous stone that wicked up moisture from some deep aquifer. Together with the rations left over from his sabbatical, it was enough to keep him going for now. For what, though? That was another matter. He still had doubts sometimes. Wondered occasionally, after some especially fruitless dig through the ruins, what he was really accomplishing out here, day after day. Whether this whole exercise might be a waste of time. A little voice in the back of his head wondered even now, as he squinted into the rising sun. Brooks bent over the pedestal, splashed water on his face, and drank. He washed his hands. That always made him feel better.